Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we feature a 2018 interview with journalist Jessica Bruder. She's the author of the 2017 book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. The book documents a new migrant workforce that has developed in this century based on seasonal and gig economy work. Often older workers living in RVs, vans, and other vehicles, moving across the country from job to job. Bruder spent months living among these workers, traveling some 15,000 miles over 3 years, spending time in the camper force, Amazon recruits during peak periods, seasonal jobs as campground hosts in national parks and forests, harvest processing jobs, and more. The book was a New York Times notable book in 2017 and was the focus of a documentary film Bruder produced titled Camper Force, and is the basis for a new feature film directed by Chloe Zhao and starring Oscar winner Frances McDormand. The film won the Golden Lion Award at the Venice Film Festival and the People's Choice Award at the Toronto Film Festival and opens a nationwide release next week. Bruder is reported for the New York Times, New York Magazine, and Harper's and teaches narrative writing at Columbia University. We feature our interview with her today on Studio Tulsa. Jessica Bruder, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
In your book, Nomadland, you discuss this new class of migrant workers, older Americans for the most part who found they can't afford to retire, or many times they can't afford to live in their house on a retirement income, and use their RVs and vans as homes. How did you first discover this new class of migrants?
Honestly, I have been really interested in a long time in the intersection of the digital economy and traditional labor issues. So I was actually reading about work in Amazon warehouses when I came upon this cohort. Way back, there was this amazing expose that was run by the Allentown Morning Call, and they were talking about a warehouse where temperatures went up to triple digits. And instead of, you know, opening the loading bay doors or bringing in air conditioning, they had ambulances stationed outside, paramedics ready to take the workers away.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, so that got me following Amazon warehouses. And there was another story in Mother Jones that came out a couple years later. And a young woman went undercover there. And I swear, it must have been two paragraphs of the story. She met one person who said, "Yeah, I live full-time in an RV, and I do this job because I can't afford to retire, and there's a whole program for people like us." And at that point, the magazine story went back to just life in a warehouse, but my brain was kind of doing, hold the phone. I really got stuck on that moment and said, well, what is this program, and who are these people? And that's really how I fell down the rabbit hole.
And once you fell down the rabbit hole, you found that there was a huge class of workers working a whole range of jobs, everything from Amazon's camper force, which I assume is built around rush times when, you know, the holidays and other times of year when they're going to have, they need to get things out very, very quickly at peak times. They use this camper force, right?
Absolutely. So it's usually in the months leading up until the Christmas holiday, which is the consumer bonanza. They need more bodies moving orders in those warehouses, and that is where camper force comes in.
But you also found that there are all sorts of jobs being accomplished by this migrant workforce that is moving from site to site and doing the work.
Absolutely. So this workforce is largely people who are at or nearing traditional retirement age. They're in late model RVs, travel trailers, some vans, a few sedans. And the range of jobs in a marketplace where ageism is such a big problem, the range of jobs for these particular people is amazing. You know, you've got people who are in their 60s who suddenly there are jobs everywhere because you can get hired to do everything from campground maintenance. That's a job called campground hosting, which sounds really jolly, but it's actually a very hard job. Involves a lot of scrubbing, lifting, cleaning, and, babysitting rowdy campers.
Cleaning to pit toilets, really.
Pit toilets, yeah, three times a day. That is the least favorite part of the job. People get jobs working as the guards at the gates of oil fields down in Texas. They help bring in the annual sugar beet harvest up in the Red River Valley. They work at tourist traps from everything from Waldrug to Dollywood. They work at theme parks, including Adventureland in Altoona, Iowa. You name it, they do it. It's this amazing workforce that, so far as employers are concerned, is basically plug-and-play labor. These are people who show up. They need the money. They show up with their houses in tow. they're really not around long enough to clamor for any benefits. And, you know, when the job is done, they go as well.
How much of this workforce came about as an effect of the housing collapse in 2008? You document several people who were profoundly affected by that. Say there was a company town that produced gypsum for sheetrock. And, of course, with the housing bubble and collapse, there's no need for sheetrock, and that actual company town closed. Or you're talking with people who had bought a house at the height of the housing bubble and seen their mortgage go underwater, and they said, why should we continue paying for this house that's underwater? And they went on the road and bought an RV and walked away. How much of it is from the aftermath? Or has this workforce been around for a lot longer than we've known about?
Yeah, it's a blended workforce. So it has been around to some degree, but it really caught fire when the Great Recession began and the housing collapse happened. I did meet people who planned to retire on the equity from their homes. And, you know, if you're younger and you kind of lose out in the market, you may have time to win it back. They didn't have time to win it back. You know, their bodies were on a time schedule like all of ours. And they had to, you know, they had to come up with a new plan. So for a lot of these people, plan B was get a cheap RV and get the heck out and find places where one can work without having the shackles of a mortgage or rent. This is all part of a larger issue, too, that's been going on for a long time in our culture, where wages have been flat. Everybody should know that the federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 for a really long time now, and housing prices keep going up to the point where there are currently only a dozen counties in the U.S. where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford a one-bedroom apartment at what's considered fair market wage. So we do have this ongoing crisis between flat wages, rising housing costs, and a lot of people who got knocked off their perches by the Great Recession.
A lot of these people you encountered, they'd worked most of their life. Some had taken time out probably to raise kids at some point. But their Social Security benefit, once they reach retirement age, and they're depending on that Social Security, has just proven to be entirely inadequate.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, Social Security was never meant to fully fund retirement. It was meant to be part of what they called the three-legged stool. People had savings. They used to have pensions, or so I hear. But, you know, pensions gave way in the 80s to 401ks, which were marketed as instruments of financial freedom, but largely outsourced the risk from employers to workers. So a lot of people kind of got the shaft with that and just can't make it on the Social Security they're earning. I saw a lot of older women on the road, which I didn't anticipate when I began the story. But just as you mentioned, lots of people earn less in Social Security when they have to take time out of the workforce to be caregivers. That's something that still primarily falls on women's shoulders. Women still, you know, are paid less than men. We've got the pay gap and that unpaid labor. So the fact that women live longer than men, coupled with all those factors, I suppose I shouldn't have been as surprised as I was to see a lot of older single women on the road, but there they were doing these jobs.
And one of the main people that you focused on in Nomadland was a woman named Linda May, whose Social Security benefit was $550 a month.
Very meager.
Yeah, very meager. Scarily meager.
And really scary. And at this point, too, I mean, when I first met Linda, she was in her 60s and, you know, she'd once been a project manager at Home Depot. Now the only job she could get at Home Depot was working the register, something she blames on ageism. She'd done every job in her life that you can imagine and then some. She'd been a long-haul trucker. She'd been a cocktail waitress. She'd owned and run a flooring store. She'd briefly been an insurance executive. She'd defeathered ducks and quails at a hunting lodge. She worked at a facility doing caregiving for people with traumatic brain injuries. You name it, Linda's been there. But she never did get a pension, like many Americans, and she was never making enough money to save. She was a single mom raising a couple kids and realized that when those Social Security checks started coming, they weren't going to offer her all that much. So she ended up heading out on the road because she needed some sort of alternative. She realized it was maybe the only way to put away a little money by saving on rent so she could just not work until the day she died. Her dream was homesteading, so saving up a little money to buy a scrap of land somewhere and try to become as self-sufficient as she could.
Yeah, she wanted to build a off-the-grid house, really, basically.
Yeah,
And she became part of the camper force at Amazon at times, and you tell her story throughout the book. It's interesting, you know, I've encountered folks like this on my own travels. I like to spend a lot of time outdoors, campground hosts, working for park concessionaires or the Forest Service or the National Park Service itself as a seasonal worker or working at a national park as a concessionaire. And, you know, I've always thought of them as that was like a retirement part-time job. And then I met a few that were, they were making a full-time job of it, moving from park to park, working a winter park during the cold winter months in a desert environment, and then working up in the mountains in the summer. And I was really surprised by this sort of nomadic existence. And I assume that's what you found through this community of migrant workers.
Absolutely. And from the outside, that's one of these jobs that looks like, oh, it must be so much fun. You get to hang out in the woods. All of the recruiting brochures say things like, you know, you'll make the best friends. You'll feel so healthy. There are pictures of gray-haired women arm in arm on sun-dappled lake shores just looking like they're at summer camp. But in truth, it's a really hard job. You're always on the clock. You can only submit a very limited number of hours to be compensated for every week. And time again, I heard about wage theft on this particular job. And, you know, wages that were going unpaid. And when people complained to the Forest Service told me, I called them after filing a Freedom of Information Act request. And they told me, yeah, when people complain, we forward the complaints back to the concessionaires. We don't have the authority to investigate. So this is a can-do workforce, but in some ways it's also really a captive workforce. They're working at will. They can be terminated without cause or notice. In some cases, after traveling hundreds or thousands of miles to get to this job that many of them need. So it's not as easy a life as it appears to be from the outside.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head there where the federal government basically is turning a blind eye. They say the concessionaire is doing work on behalf of the federal government, but they say we have no, you know, they can't look into any sort of labor practices which would be patently unlawful if conducted by the federal government.
Yeah, it's incredibly offensive to me. It's a way to just launder the whole situation, the equivalent of hiring a temp service and then letting them abuse workers horribly and just basically saying, well, that's not my problem. And these are national parks for taxpayers. We shouldn't be happy about this.
I was horrified to read that many of these migrant workers are often doing it for no money at all. They're doing it for room and board, or at the very least, well below minimum wage hourly rates, based on the fact that I think you documented just then that oftentimes the hourly rate, they're working a lot more than they're actually being paid for.
Absolutely. And some of them aren't getting paid. Some of them are doing it as volunteers. And keep in mind, it's funny, there are still people out there who kind of belong to the group of like the last great pensioners who are going out in their RVs and relaxing. And for somebody who's fortunate enough to be in that position, a volunteer gig is great. But for the many people I met who are out there as well, a volunteer gig is a euphemism for we're not getting paid except for a place to park and plug in the RV. And I do think those jobs can be exploitative. I think referring to them as volunteer jobs, particularly if they're for entities that have commercial interests, is a bit misleading.
Yeah, I think one thing you mentioned in the book was like somebody who's like working as a harbor captain or driving a boat, escorting people from one place to another via a boat. And those people were doing the job basically for a camper spot and a little bit of board.
Yeah, that was a classified ad I saw, and I found it pretty outrageous, which is why I put it in the book. Just the idea that, you know, somebody who has this specialized skill, they're able to drive a boat and to assume all this responsibility, the idea that they wouldn't be fairly compensated for what they're doing, again, I found kind of horrifying.
Today, we're featuring a 2018 interview with journalist Jessica Bruder. The Columbia University journalism professor is the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. The book documents a new migrant workforce that has developed in this century based on seasonal and gig economy work. It's now the focus of a feature film directed by Chloe Zhao and starring Oscar winner Frances McDormand, which opens nationwide next week. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You also mentioned that you spent some time at Amazon's Camper Force, and you actually found that this generation that is working as the Camper Force, you know, they're going back to, you know, that 50s work ethic, and they're oftentimes more happy about the work than, say, a person living in the community who might be much younger, a millennial. There's something about the work ethic that showed up when you were watching this unfold.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually, and according to the recruiters, this is actually one reason why hiring this demographic is so appealing. This is a can-do demographic. This is a demographic that says, you know, you get up, you do your job, you don't complain. I worry that also makes them a really exploitable demographic. I mean, I was speaking to one gentleman at the Hazlitt, Texas warehouse, and he'd spent years working in copper mines as a mechanic, and his knees were shot. And just watching him do all the squatting and the reaching and the lifting connected with this position, you know, and uncomplainingly, it was just, you know, it was hard to watch because we had this great idea that seems to have evaporated somewhat, that if you work really hard all your life, you might deserve some time towards the end of your years to actually do what you want, whether that is volunteer or do your hobbies or do some sort of light duty work that might be a little gentler on your body. But that's not what I was seeing out there.
And what was really interesting to me is when you witnessed the camper force in action, here they're using this workforce in which they're finding RV spaces for these people to work in, yet they're treating them like it's some high-profile sales job or where it's like, you know, seconds count. And, you know, the pressure of the job seems very high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a job where the worker spends 10 hours, you know, on your feet, on concrete floor in a warehouse, walking around, going up and down stairs, squatting, reaching and lifting. I met a gentleman in his 70s who was walking 15 miles a day. When I stepped inside some of the RVs of these workers, they were kitted out like mobile apothecaries with ibuprofen and Epsom salts for your foot baths and orthotics. And, you know, everybody's talking about what kind of sneakers to have. It's not easy work. I was impressed to see that they gave away free over-the-counter pain meds. There was a little machine in a warehouse called Little Medic. And to this day, I think I still have some leftover generic ibuprofen from my brief stint undercover with Amazon because they give it away like candy.
You know, it is about, you know, if you're not putting the next item in the bin within seconds, you know, or you go a couple minutes, there's a supervisor there checking on you or oftentimes scolding you.
Yeah, everybody basically has a handheld digital monitor. So this is a little barcode scanner with a trigger. And you're using it to scan bins, to scan items. And it's also tracking the work you're doing, how many picks you're doing and how much time, how many tasks you're accomplishing. And I call it digital Taylorism every now and then, just a reference to, you know, all that automation Ford era stuff that changed our culture so deeply. And for pickers, this is one of the hardest jobs where you're walking around the warehouse and actually getting orders ready to go. They do have a countdown on that handheld scanner. And it's like you're in a video game. You know, you've got 15 seconds to reach the next level. So there is a fair amount of stress associated with that.
Interesting. As you began to know many of the people that are part of this work camper workforce, you found that there's actually quite a bit of a culture around it.
Yeah, one of the things that I actually found uplifting in the middle of all this was the camaraderie. For 3 years in a row, I went to an event called the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which was primarily for van dwellers and also some RVers, but people essentially sharing road survival skills, whether it's how to get work camping jobs, where to go for cheap dental care in Mexico, how to patch a tire, how to sleep overnight on a city street in your vehicle without getting rousted by the police. That might include everything from, you know, choosing for your home a white van that looks like it could be part of a utility fleet, putting a ladder rack on it rather than an obvious sports rack, and leaving a construction worker's vest in the passenger seat. All sorts of tips and tricks.
Interesting. And this goes on in the summer. And you mentioned a place called Quartzsite. This is sort of a wintering location when a lot of the jobs dry up, right?
Yeah, when a lot of the jobs don't exist in the winter because so many of them are outside. And Quartzsite, during the summer, is triple-digit hallucinatory heat. It's got 4,000 permanent residents, and it's essentially a rest stop on the highway between Phoenix and L.A. for a big chunk of the year. But then in the winter, when the temperatures get quite pleasant and it's cold in so much of the U.S. and Canada, the whole town fills up. There are boundless acres of federal public land out there. It's part of the Sonora Desert. And people can boondock, which means camping without any RV hookups. So you're bringing your own water, your own power, your own food. A lot of people are using solar panels. So people will go out there and either for free or for a minimal fee for long-term camping, they can essentially go financially dormant for the winter, be in this great weather, and be part of a community.
Many of these migrants have worked within the system for decades of their life. So a lot of them have roots within communities. They've worked in a community for a long time, but circumstances have left them where they're on the road in an RV, in a van, in a camper. And many of them are not even going out and coming back home. They have no home at all. But I was thinking, for somebody who's had these roots for so long, government sort of wants you and requires you to have an address of some sort and requires you to register vehicles. How do they go about doing it? I think you were talking about South Dakota in the book, in which if you stay one night in a motel and register sort of an address forwarding site, you're now a resident of South Dakota. Is that right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, I have to jump in on behalf of some of my sources. They would argue with you about the having no home.
Okay.
They would tell you that this is just important to them, so it's why I want to share it with you, that they're houseless but not homeless.
Gotcha.
Just because homeless has taken such a stigma, but many of them are quite proudly houseless. And you're right, all of them legally do need to be, quote-unquote, domiciled somewhere. You need that for everything from maintaining a driver's license and insurance, which you might imagine is quite critical to the population we're talking about, to registering to vote, which unfortunately many of these people don't get to do, but we can talk more about that, to, you name it. Basically, to be considered a legitimate person in the U.S., you need to be affiliated with a street address. It's this thing that's really ingrained that kind of does equate homeownership or rentership with citizenship. So a lot of people do find that in those regards, they have to become outlaws a bit. And that either means having your domicile be a friend or family member's residence, signing up with a mail forwarding service. So you can say, my residence is this place. And then whenever that place gets the mail, they forward it to you. Or there are some states that actually kind of court people, like you mentioned South Dakota, which for a long time would allow you to show up with a receipt from one night in a motel, and that was enough to establish a residency as what they would call a traveling resident of South Dakota.
How big is this population, do you estimate?
It's hard to say because this is a demographer's nightmare. These people are hiding in plain sight. They all are officially domiciled at addresses, so it's impossible to say. So for the narrowest slice of the population we're talking about, and I would say that's people at or nearing traditional retirement age who are living full-time in vehicles with no permanent house and working these jobs, for that narrow slice, my super conservative estimate would be that we're talking about at least tens of thousands, possibly hundreds, but I can tell you for sure tens, just based on what the recruiters are saying in terms of what applications they're getting and how many of these jobs are actually available. If you want to widen that to people who are on the road full-time for a wider range of reasons, that could include millennials who are saying, I don't want to go to school and go into huge debt, and I can't afford traditional housing on what wages are available to me, and I don't want to live with my parents anymore. If you want to go that kind of wide, we could easily go into hundreds of thousands.
Now, earlier you mentioned that a member of this work camper force and van dwellers really think of themselves as houseless, not homeless. Is there a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And the stigma has only grown more acute in recent years. Right after Hurricane Irma, I don't know if you heard about this, but there was one town where people were brought to a relief shelter, and the people who arrived there from the town were segregated from the people from the homeless shelter. The latter were forced to wear yellow wristbands. A motel I heard about in Oregon where you can't rent a room unless you can prove to them that you have a street address. All over the country, towns have been cracking down on regulations that govern whether or not people can sleep in their vehicles, which culturally I think is our way of saying, look, this parking spot, your car is good enough to stay there, but you aren't. So I think that's a bit of an indictment of our values as a society. But all of this only has really made it harder for people to deal with the stigma of the word homeless, which has been a long-standing stigma. people hear homeless and they think you're a bad person. They think, I mean, it's really not a word that means what it means. It's really a word that implies a caste division in our culture. People assume that, you know, somehow you did a bad thing. There's a lot of shame and stigma right now just around poverty in our culture, even though we know that we lead all developed nations in economic inequality, and that a lot of what's caused that has been just huge systemic things rather than the fault of individuals. So between the stigma on that and the stigma on homelessness, I think it's understandable that nobody really wants to be a member of that club. So when they say I'm houseless, not homeless, it's a way of saying I'm a person, I have agency, I make decisions, and this is how I'm living.
What do you think, is this workforce going to grow larger as the 21st century unfolds? Or what is your sense of whether migration is going to get larger as the century unfolds or less?
I think it's definitely going to get larger, if only because I've seen it get larger in the process of doing this book. But the first time I went out to the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous in 2014, there were 60 vehicles. This year, I couldn't make it because I was stuck at home with work, and there were thousands of vehicles. Hmm. We've seen all these stories coming out of Silicon Valley and elsewhere in California about how people in the service industry can't afford housing anywhere near where the jobs are. So the streets are clogged with RVs, and people don't know what the heck to do about it. That's just exploded, even since the reporting of my book is finished. So I do think that we're going to continue to see it to grow, both because there are inherent problems in retirement finance, but even on a larger level, we've got this issue of flat wages and rising housing costs and really no solutions in sight in terms of what people are going to do to fix that.
You know, if you spend much time camping across the country, you'll find that a lot of times many campgrounds, especially recreational campgrounds that are near towns and places like that, they're often filled with people camping all the way up to the limit. And I assume a lot of times that's more a function of I'm working near here than I'm actually recreating.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And one of the sad things in my mind is that in some areas we've seen crackdowns rather than people trying to suggest alternatives. So, you know, up in Coconino National Park down near Flagstaff, Arizona.
Yeah, the national forest
reports,
there.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yeah.
There are reports of rangers booting people just because they can't prove that they have a street address where they live full time, and telling people that, look, everybody is entitled to stay up to 14 days here free of charge, but that doesn't include you because you have no home, and that means you're making a home of the forest, so you just have to leave right now.
Wow. The name of the book is Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Jessica Bruder, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Journalist and Columbia University journalism professor Jessica Bruder speaking with us back in 2018 here on Studio Tulsa. She's the author of the book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, which documented a new migrant workforce that has developed in this century based on seasonal and gig economy work. It's now the basis for a new feature film starring Oscar winner Frances McDormand and directed by Chloe Zhao, which has won major awards at the Venice and Toronto Film Festivals and opens a nationwide release next week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.